Reading comes from Matthew 27, 32 through 55, or 56. As they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene named Simon. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means places of the skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his clothes among themselves by casting lots. Then they sat down there and kept watch over him. Over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two bandits were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross now, and we will believe him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he wants to, for he said, 'I am God's son.'" The bandits who were crucified with him also taunted him in the same way. From noon on, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And about 3 o'clock, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani?" That is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of the bystanders heard it and they said, "This man is calling for Elijah," at once one of them ran and got a sponge, filled it with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink. But the others said, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him." Then Jesus cried again with a loud voice and breathed his last. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now when the centurion and those with him who were keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were terrified and said, "Truly, this man was God's son." Many women were also there, looking on from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee and had provided for him. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And our second verse comes from Luke 24, 50 through 53. Then he led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. While he was blessing them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven. And they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they were continually in the temple, blessing God. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
The story goes that a group of kids were in their kindergarten class doing show and tell, and first little boy, his name's Timmy, he sits up and he shows them his Star of David that he wears around his neck. And he explains that he's Jewish and he explains what the Star of David means to him and to his family. The next student, a little girl named Mary, she holds up a picture of the Buddha and explains that her family is Buddhist and what that means to them and what the Buddha means to them. And finally, the third little boy stands up and he says, "I'm a Methodist and this is my mom's favorite casserole dish." We joke about it, but I actually read a couple years ago a blog post by a well-known Christian author who suggested that one of the problems or challenges in Christianity is that we're way too comfortable with the good stuff and the good news and the happy stuff, and we're often unwilling to face the challenges that come with our faith and some of the more difficult moments. something she cited that is true for our church as well. You know, the two biggest Sundays of the year, the Sundays were cram-packed and can't find enough seats, are Christmas and Easter. The good news, the birth and the resurrection. But we're seemingly empty in that in-between time, the Maundy Thursday and Lent, and the times to reflect on the suffering and death and crucifixion of Jesus Christ. We're less willing to face the reality of our faith that says that someone had to die for us to have that we have. And we're a lot more willing to face the realities of the miraculous birth and the resurrection. In the church, sometimes we're way too focused on what's good and not nearly focused enough on what's really important. A lot of times in the church, oftentimes we become more of a social club instead of a place where transformation happens. One of the things that I hate to hear is, you know, if we had a few more people, we could make the budget, as if the people are all about giving us some more money. We all want to grow. Every church wants to grow. I've never met a church that didn't want to grow, but would we still want to grow if all the people who came, all the new people, all the new families, all the new individuals came to church, didn't have time to volunteer for anything, didn't have any money to give, and just came to worship to grow and asked us to help them? Would we still want to grow if they couldn't contribute to the church in any way? I hope the answer to that is yes. I hope the answer to that is yes, we would continue to want to grow, to want new people, even if they couldn't contribute to the things that are important to us. Because the reality of the church is that we're not about each other, we're about those outside of our walls. We didn't come here today to serve each other and to serve those who are here. We came here to prepare ourselves and equip ourselves to worship God, to serve God, and to go out from here and serve God. And this is a tough reality for Christians, but it's a reality that comes as a result of focusing on the before and the after and ignoring the reality of crucifixion. I remember Joyce's sermon several weeks ago when she talked about the needs of our community and what it means, what it really means to go out and serve those who have the most tremendous need and are in some of the most tremendous circumstances. And oftentimes in the church, we're not a cross-section of our communities. One of the things we find is we kind of go back throughout all of Christianity, especially in the Methodist Church, we find that our communities, our Christian communities, generally make more money, for example, than those around them. That the median income of the church, for example, is higher than the median income of the community the church is in. Oftentimes, our reach is to people who are like us and less to people who are in need. The Apostles' Creed doesn't skip over what we in the church like to skip over. It doesn't go straight from the miraculous birth to the resurrection. There's something in between, something that takes the church from casseroles and budgets to service and sacrifice, something that makes us not about social time and more about sacrificial love, and that something is the cross. Jesus Christ suffered under Pontius Pilate, crucified, dead, and buried, and the third day he rose from the dead, and he ascended into heaven. That's the portion of the Apostles' Creed that we're wrestling with and breaking down today. What we're being asked to affirm this morning as we continue our series, We Believe, we're exploring the foundational beliefs of the Christian faith as affirmed by the Apostles' Creed. Let's take this line by line. The Apostles made mention of Pontius Pilate, who was the Roman official who oversaw Jesus' crucifixion. And there's some significance there, right? The Apostles weren't just mentioning Pontius Pilate to fill time, right? I was really good in high school about taking a 2-page paper and making it a 5-page paper, you know. You can find a lot of adjectives to make substance out of nothingness. But the Apostles' Creed, they weren't doing that. They weren't just adding a line. There is significance, foundational Christian significance to Pontius Pilate. And that's who he is. Pontius Pilate was the prefect of Judea. He was the Roman-appointed governor to that region. When the Jews took Jesus to be crucified, sometimes we have Pontius Pilate being displayed as this anti-hero, especially in, like, Christian plays. Like he feels bad for Jesus, or he really feels sympathetic towards Jesus. The reality is Pontius Pilate didn't care. Either way, Pontius Pilate was not a Jew, was not faithful to God. Pontius Pilate was faithful to Caesar, and that was it. So when somebody comes to him and says, this guy's a heretic, and he blasphemes against God, Pontius Pilate says, so what? He really doesn't care. He's indifferent to God. He's indifferent to Jesus. He's indifferent to the people. He ultimately allows Jesus to be executed because he wants to appease the crowd. Right, famously in the story, he gives them an ultimatum. We'll release this very dangerous criminal in exchange for Jesus. He thought that would quiet them down. That didn't. And he said, fine, if you want him, take him, and I'll crucify Jesus. I don't care. I'm going home. Now, of course, his wife has a vision, and she tells him of this. And even then, Pontius Pilate says, remember, he tries to wash his hands. He says, I don't care. It has nothing to do with me. This doesn't bother me. This is totally indifferent to me. Pontius Pilate, though, is an image of authority. The reason Pontius Pilate is important in the story is because the political world was indifferent to the suffering and persecution of Jesus, and the religious world was for it. What happened to Jesus was not a foreign enemy, was not an assassination by a zealot, was not an accident, was not natural causes, it wasn't cancer. What happened to Jesus was something that the political and religious leaders wanted to happen. It was legal, it was endorsed, and it was the result of corporate sin coming together between the political world and the religious world. In confirmation, we've been talking about sin, and we talked about corporate sin. The idea that collective sin can happen, that we can sin as a group and not just individuals. And there's no greater example of corporate collective sin than the crucifixion of Jesus. The church and the state came together to conspire against God. The people who were supposed to be faithful to God were, in that moment, the least faithful ones on the planet. It was the church that made the loudest noise that wanted Jesus executed. We can't skip over that line if we're going to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus, and we can't skip over the realization that humanity as a whole at that time had been so caught up in what they wanted to believe and what was important to them that even God himself couldn't shake their beliefs or make them believe something different. That even God himself couldn't ask them to change who they were. In fact, when God dared to do exactly that, they killed them. We affirm the belief that Jesus Christ suffered under the prefect of Judea, which means that we affirm a belief that even the church can fall and turn away from God. That even the church can fail to be who God has created it to be. And our responsibility as Christians who affirm these beliefs is to keep the church faithful to God. It's very clear why Christians have to affirm the concept of Jesus' trial and execution. Without Christ's death, we lack the atonement and promise of resurrection that is essential to what we believe. If we take Christianity, we boil it down to the very basic of what it means, right? It means a relationship with Jesus Christ. But more than that, it means salvation and a promise of a better way of living, right? It means a promise to live as God created us to. And none of that can happen without the crucifixion. Atonement is one of those funny words. It's one of the few words in the faith that we actually can trace to English, right? We don't have to go back any Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek. It's just English. It stayed English. It's always been English. Atonement literally means at-one-ment, okay? That's literally where it comes from. Now, there were words in the older languages that meant the same thing, but when it got to English, they said, rather than translate it, let's just use our own words. And they would say at-one-ment. And over time, just like a lot of other English, they kind of got melded together. If you want an interesting challenge and to realize how much your language has changed, look up something from Chaucer and look up the original writings, right? You won't be able to read it. You won't even be able to recognize some of the characters, much less be able to read it. But that's English. It was English. You wouldn't be able to understand it if you heard it. Changed in hundreds of years. So we smash the words together. We have atonement. Literally means to be at one with God. Atonement is to reconcile who we are with God and to be someone that can be in the presence of God. There's four primary ways, kind of distilled to three, that we understand this. And the first of those is what's called Christus Victor, sometimes called ransom theory. Very similar, not quite the same. But Christus Victor is this idea that Jesus Christ conquered sin, that he conquered death, that Jesus Christ was God's ransom for humanity, for the sin that was existing in our world. That through Christ's death, he paid the price, he paid the ransom for sin. And that Christus Victor, he's the victor over sin, that the crucifixion was a victory, that it was a conquering, that it was the end of the war, the end of the battle between Satan and God in many ways. Now the next way is called moral influence theory. Moral influence theory is the idea that God through Jesus Christ demonstrated a way of living that's so tremendous that sin is conquered simply because we live for God now. Because we understand more now. Because through Christ's example, through his gracious life, and through his tremendous example of his crucifixion on the cross, we have been given a new way of living and a new way to understand life and a way to live life without sin. It's kind of simplifying it, but moral influence theory essentially says that Jesus gives us a better way to live that causes us to turn from sin. The third one is kind of the hardest one. It's really tough. It's really a hard pill to swallow. It's been popularized by John Calvin. It's been popular for about 1,000 years. It's actually the newest of all the atonement theories. Christus Victor is the oldest. Ransom theory kind of came around that same time too. But it's called substitution theory. Okay? Substitution theory is this idea that you and I deserved a punishment for our sins. That our lack of being who God has called us to be means that you and I deserve something as a result of failing to be who God called us to be. And Jesus Christ took that punishment on the cross, and that it wasn't just Pontius Pilate and the Jews who were crucifying Jesus, but you and I, through our actions, failing to live as God would call us to live, were responsible for each of those stripes across his back. That's really tough. It's a tough pill to swallow. It hurts to hear and say. It should, right? This idea that we're responsible for the death of Christ because we've failed and have failed and will fail to be who God created us to be. God didn't create us to sin. God didn't create us to be greedy, to fail to love one another, to fail to care for one another. But we do, because sin has a hold of our lives. And each of them is tough, but they all have one similarity, one thing that's important, and that's the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I suggest that each of them has a component of truth, and each of them probably come together to help us understand atonement in some way. Like a lot of other things in Christianity, these aren't beliefs that are often hard felt by many Christians, but they are ways of understanding what we believe. We believe that Christ offers us atonement. These are some ways that we understand how that works. But to understand those beliefs is to understand that Jesus Christ was crucified, died, was buried, and rose again. This is a key component of our faith. To believe that Jesus Christ suffered and was crucified and died is to believe that Jesus Christ has the power to conquer sin. To believe Christ's power is to believe that in that one moment, he was seemingly powerless, but he conquered everything. The final line reminds us of Christ's resurrection. We read that briefly from Luke. In those final moments, Jesus Christ ascended into heaven, leaving us with the Holy Spirit that we discussed last week. Similarly, Christ's ascension completes the concept. Now, there is a little bit of a controversy. I told you about this in the first week. I said there was something in the United Methodist hymnal that is omitted from the Apostles' Creed, and that's in this section, okay? And that is, he descended into hell. We read it the first week. I don't know if you caught it. But if you caught it, we said descended into hell. We haven't said that since because we've been reading it from the hymnal. The reason that's omitted is to help us understand what is actually a long-held Christian belief. The only way we see examples of Christians believing that Jesus was physically in hell is from a misunderstood reading of the Apostles' Creed. I think a better way to do it would be to translate it better, but for the UM Publishing House, their better way to do it was to put it in the footnotes and omit it. But I think it's important, and I don't think it should be omitted. I think it should be translated more correctly. The reality is, throughout Christian history, there has not been a solidified belief that Jesus spent time physically in hell. The reality is that the word they use in Greek was Hades. Hades does not translate to hell. Hades translates to the afterlife. It could mean hell, it could mean heaven, or it could mean nothing. Hades is really a euphemism for having died, having physically died. It's like you and I saying having passed on, right? Or someone might say that they've gone on to the afterlife, right? It doesn't mean anything specific. It just means death. And here's the significance to it. The significance of Jesus dying and having that line in there is to solidify some early Christian heresies that were happening. One belief was a belief that's held was held by a number of Christians in that early time period. And that was the idea that Jesus Christ wasn't crucified, that somebody else was crucified in his place. Some Christian groups, and similarly Christian groups, still believe this today. The idea is that Jesus found somebody to go in his place and be crucified for him. The Romans were these white folks from the West, and they couldn't tell them apart anyway, the Middle Easterners, so they got somebody to stick up on the cross for them. The Roman guards didn't care. You said he's Jesus, fine, as long as I get to stick a nail in somebody and I get to go home, okay? That's the idea. Now, the other idea was that Jesus didn't actually die. He was severely injured, and they were just in such a hurry, they stuck him in the tomb, and 3 days later, he woke up from his coma. Neither of those accept the majesty and miraculousness of Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. So the apostles made sure to mention that, yes, he was actually all the way stone cold dead. He descended into death is probably a better way to translate that. He was really, truly, and genuinely dead. We're reading these scriptures. There's a few examples where we see the same concept of Jesus having departed this earth. But again, the word used consistently is Hades, again, meaning some afterlife, having been totally and completely dead. We don't have any Christian belief from that early time period. We trace it back hundreds of years before we even get the first concept of that. We don't have a Christian belief genuinely solidified in our Christian history that Jesus spent time in hell, or that he needed to, or that Satan had enough power to make as some sort of a requirement. The reality is we're kind of grasping at straws to say that he did, but he did, in fact, genuinely and truly die. Jesus was really, actually dead. That sounds silly to have to mention it like that, but it's true. To understand the resurrection of Jesus Christ is to understand that he really was dead, that Jesus Christ's body was broken, defeated, and that he really was dead. When you lean towards the idea that Christ conquered sin or that Christ took your punishment in ransom, they don't work without the belief that Christ died and rose again. I'm so excited for Advent and Christmas. It's my favorite time of year. I love Christmas. I love Advent. I'm excited about some of the new opportunities we're getting this year. I mentioned last week we're going to be working with St. John's GCC. We're going to be doing a Vesper service with them, which is going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be 10 in the morning. I know some of you can't make that, but some can, and that's just going to be a great way for us to worship with our community and be connected with other churches in our community. We hope to invite other churches in the future and expand this. But, I mean, we're really excited about the ways in which we're getting to serve God in our community through Advent and get this excited about the work that we're doing in our community. I love Christmas. I love Christmas decorations. If people would let me, I'd have put my Christmas decorations up a month ago. But it doesn't matter without the resurrection, right? And it doesn't matter without the crucifixion. Jesus Christ being born in a manger, like we talked about last week, it doesn't matter without the resurrection and the crucifixion. It has no meaning without these incredible parts that have to come next. A lot of you know I'm a huge Formula One fan. For those who don't know, Formula One, it's racing. It's open-wheel racing. And unlike NASCAR, where the cars haven't changed in 50 years, I think they're on, like, what, Generation 7? Formula One's on, like, Generation 63. You know, they're constantly updating. They're super high-tech cars. And what's really cool about them is that the technology in Formula One is one day probably going to make it to your car. If your car has anti-lock brakes, traction control, stability control, a turbocharger, a small engine that makes as much power as a big engine, if it has aluminum or carbon fiber, or any number of, if it's a hybrid, those technologies came from Formula One. And that's cool to me because I'm kind of a techie, nerdy kind of guy, and I think that's really cool to see technology evolving. But what's really exciting about this weekend is that this is the Austin Grand Prix in Texas. It's the only race in the United States of America. And because it's in the central time zone, I actually get to watch it live. I don't have to DVR it. It's not at 3 in the morning or 10 in the morning while I'm at church. It's in 2 in the afternoon, and I get to watch it live, right? It's like the Super Bowl for me, okay? I don't care about football. So this is the one time I get to really be excited about a sport in the afternoon on a Sunday. and it's exciting to watch. It's exciting because of that. But I've been watching it this weekend, and as you know, a hurricane hit the west coast of Mexico and is spilling off into Texas. So they've had a tremendous amount of rain. They canceled qualifying yesterday, and they're going with the practice times. And during practice, there was so much water on the track that the cars, the bodies of the cars, was actually skidding across the water like a surfboard. I mean, that's how bad it was. The Formula One races in the rain. They're not like NASCAR, and they don't, you know, sit in the garage and cry about it. But they race in the rain. But when there's so much water on the track that that the cars can't even get through the water, they had to finally cancel it. And it's amazing to watch because these are still 800 horsepower carbon fiber high-tech cars, but they're totally useless if they can't touch the track, right? In the same way, our faith, I did have a point to this, see? In the same way, our faith is totally useless if we don't have all the components of Christ's miraculous life, death, and resurrection in it together. That's why we affirm the Apostles' Creed, and that's why we're doing this, because we have to have all of these components together for it to work and for it to mean something in our lives. I read one account of the crucifixion from Matthew this morning. My prayer for us is that we would take time to reflect on these accounts as we progress through the Christian year, that we never forget to reflect on the gracious life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ and how essential that is for us, that we would live as Christians who believe that Jesus Christ suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried, that he descended into death, and that on the third day, for you and I, he rose again. Amen.